You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, June 1st, 2020. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps and steps and steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Scott Roberts, Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaigning for Color of Change. And then John Barry, Professor, Tulane University School of Public Health, author. The 2004, the Great Influenza. Meanwhile, Donald Trump literally and figuratively heads to a bunker as protests rock dozens of cities across the country, leading to thousands of arrests. Meanwhile, Minnesota Attorney General Keith Ellison now been appointed to handle the prosecutions of Floyd's killers. And in city after city, police show zero restraint, validating the protests in real time. Meanwhile, SCOTUS today will make a decision on whether the concept of qualified immunity will stand. Customs and Border Patrol goes rogue, sends a drone over the Minneapolis protests. New polls, Donald Trump's disapproval numbers grow, and 60% of people favor outbreak mitigation versus restarting the economy. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court rules 5-4 in favor of California's right to issue stay-at-home orders that impact churches. And congratulations to these guys. Healthcare CEO pay is four times larger than our nation's infectious disease research. Lindsey Graham asked for older Republican judges to step down to aid in court packing with younger conservative lunatics. And a released transcript of Michael Flynn's Russian embassy conversations shows he lied about the call. All this and more on today's program. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. I think people are a little frazzled, I would imagine. Some folks still probably shot full of what do you call it, I can't even remember what that thing is called. I have none of it at the moment.
Adrenaline,
yes, from the weekend. I know Matt was out in the protest. Brendan was riding through. I imagine Jamie was as well. At the very least at Barclays started off the weekend. And by the end of the weekend, obviously Minneapolis, but states around the country, there were arrests in literally dozens of cities. Los Angeles, there were over 900 in New York, 800. Houston, over 500 in Atlanta, almost 300. Philadelphia, near 300, Chicago, near 250, Minneapolis, 155, San Jose, Kansas, Detroit, all in the 80s, Denver, 83, Dallas, 74. These are AP numbers. Columbus, Ohio, over 50, Portland, over 50, Miami, over 50, Milwaukee, over 50, Charlotte. The list goes on and on. In time after time, We saw examples of the police instigating violence. I mean, certainly there are other folks who were, you know, doing property damage. Some of it arguably dangerous to people, but the greatest threat to the physical well-being of people, I think unequivocally, has come from police officers. And there was, in many instances, concerted efforts to interfere with people protesting for the sake of interfering with people protesting. There are a couple of examples around the country where the police force, the local police forces, reacted in a completely different way. I think in Flint, I saw a footage of local sheriff basically announcing, putting our batons down, putting our helmets down, we're going to walk with you guys. Up here where I am at, very similar situation. There's certainly examples of it. And, but without a doubt, there are people who are, you know, angry enough to smash some windows. And there are other instances where you have protesters stopping other people from trying to do that. But the one sort of consistent, I think, to the extent that you can make a general statement about what took place over this weekend, was that in police force after police force across the country, there was no restraint. Police immediately assumed a posture of an occupying force. Of, we've got to shut down this protest, as opposed to, we've got to try and make sure that these things remain nonviolent. And I think in some instances, I feel like it's safe to say that, at least in terms of the way that some of these police departments are acting, and I'm not saying it's necessarily an edict from their official leadership, but there certainly were police who were basically saying, we welcome this fight. We welcome this fight, and we're going to engage in it, and we're not afraid to start it. And that's fundamentally not how police are supposed to act by anybody's definition. And, you know, I, the closest thing that we're going to get to any type of response to what happened in terms of something that could actually be fundamentally meaningful, there are, I think, like something like 13 cases right now today that will be, reviewed or assessed or by the Supreme Court, and they will, today the Supreme Court will announce whether it will hear some of those cases and reconsider a doctrine called qualified immunity. What is qualified immunity? It is a legal doctrine that basically provides immunity to police and all other government officials from engaging in any illegal or unconstitutional acts, unless a court has specifically addressed a almost identical situation and found that it is an exception to this qualified immunity. So it is a legal hurdle that is, I mean, very, very difficult to overcome. Because, and I'm talking about from a civil procedure standpoint, and perhaps even from a criminal procedure, the victim has to find a decision by either a federal appellate court in the jurisdiction they're in, or the Supreme Court, which says that the exact conduct that was done in this instance has been found illegal or unconstitutional in an earlier instance. And if that doesn't exist, then the cop, or, you know, if it's another, it basically walks. And it is a doctrine that was, I guess, developed in 1982 by the Supreme Court. And in many respects, that is one of the things that makes it very, very hard. There are a lot of other things that can be done. But to hold police to account, you know, there's, and Jamie and I, I'm sure we'll talk more about this in the fun half, but there have been a lot of reforms that have been attempted. And the fact is, it seems to me that vast majority of them are ineffective. That the real reform that needs to take place, because there's more, but the primary one, as far as I can tell, involves accountability. Means you shoot somebody, you're immediately in a crap storm. And just how big of a crap storm, the facts will bear that out. But as soon as you shoot somebody, as soon as you kill somebody, as soon as you get complaints, whatever it is, there's going to be accountability. And to the point where you want the police force calling for more training so that they can function within the narrow parameters that they have without getting in trouble. That's what you want. We need essentially tighter leashes on the police. There's other things too, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But let's just play. Do we have time to play this, or do we have our guest? We're running a little bit late, aren't we?
Yeah, he's on.
Okay, let's bring on Scott Roberts. He's the Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaign for Color of Change.
Here he comes.
Here he comes.
Oh.
Scott?
Yes.
Thanks for joining us. Maybe we get you to move your, just shift your camera over so you're not shooting into the, yeah, there we go.
I wasn't sure if I was actually going to be on video or not. So.
Oh, well, there you go. Window as a backdrop is tough because I think you're good right there. So you're the senior director of criminal justice for Campaign for Color of Change. Give me a sense. I mean, when you look at, I mean, obviously we have the catalyst for these protests, right? Where one cop sticks his knee into someone's neck for 10 minutes. This is a cop who has a history of complaints of, this is a cop who, and there's three others who are just basically standing there. You know, I don't know if they're egging him on, but they're certainly sort of like, they're not doing anything. And then we have this whole sort of other set, which I think, like, you know, the protests bared out that there's a, mentality amongst police forces across the country that they can do whatever they want. What, From the perspective of Color of Change, like, what kind of reforms do you folks call for? What do you think would be effective?
Yeah, well, I think at the end of the day, big picture, we've got to reexamine fundamentally what it means for our communities to be safe. What are the things that our communities actually need for safety, and reassess what we're investing in, right? So, you know, one of the things that we're seeing, and I think, you know, we all know we're in the middle of this global pandemic, and that the coronavirus is disproportionately impacting Black communities. And I think, you know, that is part of the frustration that we're seeing. But in the midst of that, local governments are putting out their budgets. It's that season. It's happening all over the country, including Minneapolis. And what we're seeing is everything being cut, you know, education, social services, healthcare, except policing. Policing is getting increases. And I think that the timing of all of this is really in some ways fortuitous. It gives us an opportunity to really look at what we're doing. You know, that's what we're seeing on the news every night now is what we're investing in. So there are places where the majority of the city budget, like Los Angeles, the majority of the city budget, 54% of the budget is going to the LAPD. And we're seeing how they're treating these communities right now. We would love to see, you know, us pulling back on policing and investing in the things that we feel like are going to make our communities safer: education, housing, jobs, and also just even in the interventions that come with safety, right? Like, you know, so often we're seeing police respond, these incidents kind of happening when police are responding to issues around mental health or people in crisis, right? And how are we just having a different, how are we funding and paying for a different response? How, I think we need to look at the kind of community-based solutions to both issues like mental health, but also even to violence, right? Where we have really well-proven community-based solutions to help de-escalate and mediate community-based violence. But instead, we've neglected all of these things, and we've invested so much in policing. But in addition, I think there are things that we can do within policing to lessen the amount of police violence that we're seeing. We need to hold police officers, we need to lower the standards, frankly, for holding police officers accountable, right? Like, right. There's such a high standard for both at the federal level and at state levels. We worked on legislation in
California. By high standard, let me just clarify, yeah, that you have to do something that is so egregious. And also, you know, they're looking at the qualified immunity right now at the Supreme Court today. You need to do something that's so egregious and has already been done and found to be that egregious to be held to account. Otherwise, you just slide under.
Right. So, you know, I think, we need to readjust those standards, make it easier for the feds to hold officers accountable. There are a lot of issues with police unions, you know. I mean, you know, color of change, it's delicate, but, you know, because we are very pro-labor. I personally grew up in a union household, you know, but police unions, they're not part of our movement, you know. They are the, I would say, primary impetus to holding officers accountable because of the many obstacles that they work into police contracts that make it very difficult to hold officers accountable. Even in Minneapolis, you know, we all were happy to see the quick firing of the officers, right? You know, beyond, you know, before we get to the point of charges, the officers were fired pretty promptly, you know, I think that alone is a sign of progress. We couldn't even get that type of stuff, you know, 4 or 5 years ago. But there's a arbitration board in Minneapolis that has the power to reinstate those officers. And its history is reinstating 50% of all officers who were fired. There's also, we've been reading up, and I think we've got this right, that there's a clause in the police contract that says officers have to have like 3 days before they can be fired. That didn't happen in this case. So there's a question of whether or not this police contract that the union was able to put in place actually means that these folks, the firing was invalid and they may be able to be brought back onto the force. So, you know, then we've got law enforcement officers' bills of rights, all these things that police unions have pushed through that make it almost impossible. So we need to push back on those things. I think for us, we're also, you know, one of the things that we focus on in terms of making change is identifying those people who have a vested interest in the status quo and mitigating their political power. And so I think, you know, we really have to kind of expose who's behind this right now, being police unions primarily, and the kind of, and mostly conservative politicians or law enforcement friendly politicians who have aligned themselves with police unions. We're excited to see in New York that some politicians are starting to give back the money this week or over the weekend that police unions have given them. So I think going after the policies that they've put in place, but also you know, try to leverage this moment to build the power to be able to take them on around these contract disputes, things like that, or contract negotiations.
And I think Austin has done specifically has engaged in those type of like reforms of their union contract, right? That make it much easier to hold cops accountable. So if I hear what you're saying, that in terms of what your program is, it starts with not totally defunding police departments, but shifting a considerable amount of resources away from police and into the communities that they're supposedly policing. And then holding police to account by various number of means so that they can actually like change their own behavior in their, you know, so that there are just narrower parameters. Right. And I think like the idea is that in some respect in defunding them, it narrows their mandate as to what areas they can go into. Right. It also seems to me like there's other, I would imagine, subsidiary ones like forfeiture of assets in the way that needs to be reformed. But the main ones, if I'm hearing what you're saying, is make these police departments smaller, and I would imagine without that funding, less militarized, and make them accountable every time they do something that we don't want them to be doing.
That's right. You know, I think there's in addition to the ways we're talking about, I think one of the really critical things is community oversight. You know, community oversight boards that actually have disciplinary power. You know, we've seen a kind of a proliferation of some of the boards over the last few years, but oftentimes they really don't have the power. You know, in a place like New York, for instance, the board is made up of like half police officers and retired officers. Right. You know, they're not truly community boards. So, you know, we need to fix the ones that are out there, and we need more of them in more communities. But at the end of the day, the police are just not accountable right now to us, you know, based on the power that the police unions have, the way that many politicians have kind of cowered before them, frankly, and the lack of accountability at the community level.
Is this something that we can do? I mean, everything you've talked about, for the most part, are local initiatives. Like, is this what, like, you know, aside from like the broad concept of immunity that the Supreme Court could deal? Is there any type of federal fix for all of these things? I mean, or any of them, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's definitely things we need to do at the federal level. I would say that. I think you're right, though, that to say that a lot of the real fixes, especially around accountability, have to happen at the local level. But I think the federal government,
well, you can't have a piece of federal legislation that says you got to cut 20% of your 25% of your police budget, right?
It would be tough. I mean, the only mechanism that we have is the federal funding, right? So there's a bunch of federal funding that comes from the Department of Justice that goes to departments, and we do have, that's the kind of leverage that can be used to push departments to do things like better report their instances of violence. We don't have a clear national database for police killings in the United States, right? Like what the Washington Post and other folks have had to build that. So there is legislation around that, that would, put that database in place. And yes, there would, you know, if you didn't comply with that, your funding would be, at risk. You talked about you know, immunity and how we can deal with that. I think the federal government can certainly decrease funding for things like militarization, you know, and the transfer of military equipment to police departments. But also there's the DOJ, right? This isn't even really legislative. I think we can legislate more of a mandate for the DOJ, or I think Representative Omar has talked about actually creating an independent agency that investigates every police killing. So I think we need that, you know. But a lot of this is also depending on the administration. You know, the Trump administration has been slow to investigate some of these cases. They kind of turned it up right now. You know, we're heading into the election. They have a strategy around black voters that I think, you know, is informing that. But what they haven't been doing are the patterns and practice investigations. What we really need. These are the things that look at police departments as a whole, not just an individual incident. It says, why does a guy like the officer who was kneeling on George Floyd's neck have 18 complaints and still is on the force, right? What's going wrong in their systems that's allowing that? And the Trump administration has not only not launched any patterns and practices investigations, they've tried to end the ones that were put in place by the Obama administration in places like Baltimore and Chicago, and ending both the investigations, but also the consent decrees that were settlements that came out of those investigations that actually put some systemic reforms in place in those places. So, you know,
How effective were those consent decrees from your perspective?
It's better than not having them. I'll say that, you know, okay. I think that ultimately what you said earlier is right. That like, we really have to make these changes at the local level. I think a lot of it still depends on, what local politicians want to do in terms of the consent decrees, if they're fighting them, if they're cooperating. But there's things that they can put in place that can definitely help communities hold.
This seems to me to be the biggest challenge is that you need to do this locality by locality.
Yeah.
And there's also this sort of like within those localities. I mean, you could do this on a state level. On a municipal level, and you might be able to get sort of enough majorities there, maybe.
Maybe.
But then you've got this sort of like in many of these places, this rural urban divide, which also, you know, breaks down, not totally, but very much race is a component of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you have like, you know, Minnesota's looking at Minneapolis and going like, we don't, you know, like we want the cops basically. We'll have them circle and just keep it there.
Right.
And that seemed to me to be a big, big challenge here.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. And beyond even what the points that you're making, which are really valid, there's preemption, right? Which is where states overrule what local reforms folks put in place at the local level. We've seen that happen around voting rights and gun violence prevention measures. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it also happening at the around policing policy. Should we get some of these reforms in place, that we'll see states making it more difficult for localities to make those changes.
Yeah, so. And lastly, you know, we hear people basically coming out and saying, you know, vote, you know, go and vote. But the fact is that in some of these situations, it's like, well, part of the problem is that there's not enough people to vote out these politicians who are doing the bidding of other groups of people in the state who are perfectly fine with the cops being, you know, because you've got two different experiences of the police a lot of times. And the people who have the experience of like, yeah, no, they're great. If there's someone strange in my neighborhood, I call and they come and make sure that, my house is fine, versus the people who are actually being, you know, policed as if they're, you know, being occupied.
Right. And I mean, that's why this movement is so critical, I think. And I feel like, you know, we are definitely raising all of the obstacles that are in the way, but I don't want people to lose hope because people are seeing what's happening. You know, I think even I feel like there's a difference in terms of the diversity of voices that are calling for change now. And even 5 years ago when we were dealing with Ferguson, you know, there was clear evidence during that period of like heightened movement activity that public opinion was shifting around policing and race during that time. So I do think, you know, we're in this for the long haul. Like you said, we have to do so much change place by place. That takes time. We have to continue to change people's hearts and minds when it comes to policing. You know, some people, you know, Dave Chappelle had a joke. This was almost 20 years ago in his, I think, Killing Them Softly special, where he talked about how, you know, white people would just discover, you know, when they watched the Rodney King thing, you know, oh, wow, they're really doing that. You know, I think stuff that we take for granted in our communities. And so I do think we have to keep lifting it up. I think, you know, the protests are important. I do think that a lot of people are starting to see the light. I think it's unfortunate right now that we have such a divided nation politically, and especially with the administration that's in the White House, that, you know, it's going to shut. Some people are just going to be shut off to anything, you know, but You know, I think we've been making progress. We're going to have to convince a lot of people, you know, if we want to be able to make change at the state level. And like you said, in rural communities and places that don't have large communities of color. But I think, you know, we've been making progress. I'm glad to see that we're back in a moment where people are paying attention to this. And I do think the election is going to matter, you know. Not here to like endorse anybody, but I do think that, you know, who we put in places like the White House and in Congress will make a difference. I think even if you see like seeing the squad over the last week, you know, they went in office the last time this jumped off, and you could see like Presley and Omar, they've introduced a resolution trying to push Congress to condemn this kind of police violence. And so we're seeing more leaders who are coming into office. We're seeing local prosecutors have been elected around the country who are doing a better job of holding police accountable. So the movement has been making progress, but it's going to be a long haul for sure.
Well, Scott Roberts, Senior Director of Criminal Justice Campaign for Color of Change, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And, you know, stay safe and crazy times.
All right. Thank you, Sam.
Appreciate it. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break and just for a moment. And when we come back, we're going to be talking to John Barry. Now, you know, I should say, like, we weren't sure today if we should go on with the sort of the interview that we had scheduled. Obviously, the essence of what's going on is a function of specifically what happened in Minneapolis, but also just the ongoing, 250, 300 years, 400 years of the way that our society has been treating black people. And also part of this mix that I think has, resulted in what we're seeing in terms of the protests is a function of the coronavirus and the sort of frustration in society, and particularly the fact that we have this type of racial disparity and income disparity in people who have contracted it and who it's impacted and who's died from it. And so I think there are things that we can learn from the 1918 pandemic, and to get a sense of, like, you know, where things are going, and just broadly, because frankly, I wouldn't predict what's going to happen by Friday right now. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to John Barry. He is a professor at Tulane University School of Public Health. He's the author of The Great Influenza About the 1918 Pandemic. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. I'd like to welcome to the program John Barry. He's a professor at Tulane University, the School of Public Health, the author of The Great Influenza, which was written with 2004, I believe, and is now a bestseller for obvious reasons. John Barry, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Yeah, for unfortunate reasons.
Indeed.
So it was a bestseller when it came out.
Ah, all right. So, well, that's, and there were other people who may have had at least a little bit of foreshadowing, I guess. And let's start there, because, you, in 2000, I know it was in the aughts. You were appointed to a commission that George W. Bush set up to deal with pandemics. Just give me a sense of like the work you did on that commission, and you know what is of that work? What remains of that work today? I guess.
Okay. Well, the Bush administration and he personally was the prime mover. Got very involved in pandemic preparedness. They passed a $7 billion bill. It created the national stockpile, invested a lot of money in vaccine research and technology, did all sorts of other things. And part of that was trying to figure out what so-called non-pharmaceutical interventions would be. In other words, what do you do when you don't have any drugs? What kind of public health practices made sense that might mitigate a pandemic? So that process was what I was involved in personally. And the federal plan, and in fact, all 50 states, they each have a plan. All of them start out with the number one step in this. I kept beating on this based on what happened in 1918, was that you tell the truth, that total transparency is the number one requirement to get the public to adhere to public health recommendations. So the second lesson from studying 1918 is that social distancing and other measures like that work, which we know not only from our impact here, but from other countries around the world. So the transparency, we've obviously had a problem with. And largely because of it, I think there's been reluctance by too many people to adhere to the social distancing and hand washing and mask recommendations. And that is hurting our ability to fight the pandemic. And then, of course, national stockpile problems, testing failure, the PPE issue, all those things are problems as well, not yet resolved, unfortunately.
So, I mean, I'm glad you gave the two big lessons because, I've been following what you've been writing over the past couple of months and some of the interviews you've done, and obviously reading some from your book. And I was going to ask you, and I want to actually go through, why that's a lesson that we learned in 1918 in terms of transparency and in terms of social distancing. But let's just start with, is there a third lesson as well? I want to go just two deeper than most of the other times I've heard you talk about this. Is there a third one in terms of what maybe, if there is one, what would that be?
No, I think those to cover it.
Okay.
Again, the public health advice is crucial to saving lives in a pandemic. And you're not going to get adherence to it unless you tell the truth. I think that's been demonstrated around the world. In China, of course, so to qualify that, obviously you have a boot that of an authoritarian government that can shut things down. But we're in a free society. So
let's talk about why, what it was about 1918's pandemic that it became so clear, the need for transparency. One of the things I think prior to this event that I was aware of, the 1918 pandemic, was just how little it seemed to remain in the consciousness of the country. And I don't know if that's a function of the way that it was treated at the time, or if it was just because it was overshadowed by World War II. But what were the mistakes made in 1918 around transparency that show us how important it is today?
Well, for very different reasons from today, the government lied. And in 1918, there was fake news, but it was fake because newspapers were knowingly printing what the government was telling them, and knowing that these things were not true. They were printing them anyway. But again, for different reasons. We were at war, and the government had created something called the Committee for Public Information, a propaganda arm. The architect of the committee said, you know, truth and falsehood are arbitrary terms. Nothing in experience tells us one is preferable to the other. All that matters is their inspirational value. Then in addition, they had a law that punishable by 20 years in jail to utter, write, print, or publish any disloyal, profane, scurrilous, or abusive language about the government of the United States. And they enforced that law. So between the desire to inspire people to be patriotic and help with the war effort, and the fear, the stick of prosecuting you if you said anything that was negative, truth wasn't even a defense. You know, the newspapers went along with self-censorship, and when the government said things like, this is ordinary influenza by another name, it was referred to as Spanish influenza, although it didn't start in Spain. And newspapers published that, and people knew they were being lied to. They would. It's not, you know, there are now some people honestly think this whole thing is overblown. Nobody thought it was overblown in 1918. Well, number one, nobody was hyping it. But more importantly, you know, people could die in less than 24 hours. The virus was much more lethal than what we're facing today. Well, thank God, because what we're facing today is bad enough. You know, some of the symptoms were horrific, and not at all like ordinary influenza. But in Little Rock, for example, a few miles outside Little Rock, you've got an army camp where doctors are writing thousands of cots, you know, lining the barracks, being transformed. Here, there is nothing but death and destruction. And just a few miles away, the Little Rock newspaper is writing things like Spanish influenza, same old chills and fever. Nothing to it. And in Philadelphia, when they are digging mass graves and finally close schools and, you know, churches and so forth and so on, one of the newspapers actually says, this is not a public health measure. You have no reason for fear or panic. You have no reason for alarm. So people know these are lies, and the result was counterproductive. Instead of reassuring people, they got, you know, with a deadly threat, knowing they're being lied to, you create panic. Since they know they can't believe anything they're being told, all that does is spread rumor. And alienation, everybody for himself or herself, your own families. The result is you actually have reports of people starving to death because nobody had the courage to bring them food, when they were too sick to take care of themselves. And that happened in big cities and in rural communities.
And we should say it the irony of, I guess the reporting on it was that it got the name Spanish flu simply because Spain was the first country to acknowledge that it existed.
Essentially, because they were not at war, and the European nations all had a censored press, and in the U.S. it was self-censored, but it had self-censorship was by and large very effective.
Okay, so let's and what was there? I mean, I guess I don't want to get to this too early, but I guess we're sort of here, like this notion that we can't trust the government because they're saying, and we can't trust the newspapers as institutions because they're saying this is no big deal. Yet I know that down the road, there's, you know, dozens of people with literally like the symptoms could be like blood pouring out of like your nose, right? Or your mouth.
That's correct. And some army camps where we have good data, 15% of troops actually had nosebleed, and a much fewer number, but much scarier. People could bleed from their mouth as well, and even their eyes and ears. And you imagine that happening to lay people in a civilian population. That is frightening. not exactly reassuring if you're a healthcare professional either.
So will you just walk us through the multiple waves? Because there was, and I know that there was, particularly around the time that you you printed this, there was some controversy over the question of how the virus mutated and whether the first wave and the second wave were the same, I guess, version of this flu.
Well, you're correct. There are a minority of virologists who are not quite willing to concede that the first wave was quite mild, and it was also spotty. By no means was every place hit. In fact, a minority of places were hit. Western Europe was pretty hard hit by it, but in the rest of the world, including the United States, it was hit or miss. And it was also very mild. So mild, there were medical journal articles suggesting that it looked and smelled like influenza, but not enough people were dying, so it probably wasn't influenza. Then the second wave turned really lethal. And because of those differences in virulence, a few virologists are not willing to accept. They don't dispute it exactly. They're just not sure yet that it was the same virus. I think the evidence is overwhelming that the virus is the same. I could go into great detail, but that would be a waste of your time. Let me just say that we now have a virus that has been sequenced from as early as May 1918, which is the same virus as the ones that's been circulated in the fall. In addition, if you got sick in the first wave, you had pretty high immunity, as high as 89% against effectiveness against getting sick in the second wave. And you compare that to a modern influenza vaccine in the last 20 years has ranged from 10% effectiveness to 62%. So when the immunity you're getting from exposure to the first wave is significantly better than the best modern vaccine, and when the two virus samples, when that as early as May is the same as the fall virus. And there are other reasons as to why I think it's the same virus. And I think most virologists think it's the same virus. I am not a virologist.
Right.
Make that clear.
Well, so why was the second wave so much more devastating than the first?
Well, the virus changed. We're not quite sure how. Could be some other differences, could be environmental factors. I don't think so. Could be the bacterial environment, you know, since a lot of deaths were from bacterial pneumonia, secondary invaders. I really think it's just a mutation of the virus. It was also much more widespread. I think the virus just got better at infecting people.
I mean, I guess from a total layperson's perspective, another big lesson of this is that, like, it's highly there's some basic things that you can predict, but then after that it's just sort of like you just don't know.
Well, that's true, particularly with influenza. Is one of the fastest mutating viruses in existence, so I mean that's what it does. That's why you need a different vaccine every year. I should say that even in the spring, when it was generally mild, there were pockets of virulence that gave strong hints that it could be very lethal. I am not in the slightest worried that COVID-19 is going to turn more virulent. There isn't any evidence in any, you know, it does mutate, but much more slowly than influenza. Seems a lot more stable. There's no hint anywhere that the virus is going to become more virulent. So if your listeners are worried about the second wave of COVID-19, I wouldn't worry about that.
You wouldn't worry about it insofar as it being particularly more lethal than it is now, which is still, we should say, obviously 100,000 people more in, you know, effectively 2.5 months or so of it being in the country, particularly when we were all, you know, many of us staying at home, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
That's pretty lethal. It's just that you don't anticipate it turning into something even more lethal.
Correct. It is bad enough as it is. And, it, you know, we were, as you just said, when a lot of us were staying at home, at the time that we were, that most of the country went into lockdown, if you look at the numbers, and it's a pretty simple mathematical equation, there would be over 500,000 deaths by now if we hadn't done that, I think. And the worst case projections for that virus were 2 million deaths. And I think we would have been fast on our way to the worst case and maybe even exceeding the worst case if we had not intervened. We actually stopped the first wave. You know, it's still spreading in the United States. You know, we were a long way from where Germany is, say, not to mention South Korea. But, I mean, we have those many countries have done much better in terms of turning the curve downward than we have. But we made a lot of progress. You know, hopefully coming out of lockdown, people will social distance and wash their hands and put masks on and keep it from exploding again. It's still a threat.
I want to return to sort of like, you know, where we go from here and make an assessment of how we've done. But I also want to talk about something that I found really interesting. And this actually came up in an interview that I did last week on Keynes, who traveled as part of, I guess, a contingency of folks traveled to Versailles for the peace process following World War One.
Right.
And
right.
And so and this came up in that conversation about Wilson, who never is, as far as I understand it, mentioned the Spanish flu epidemic pandemic, I guess, in the United States or anywhere, never mentioned it publicly ever, yet came down with it. And tell us this story, because the implications of what happened with Wilson catching this seem to have reverberated over the course of the next, well, till today, I would imagine.
Well, that virus in 1918 could infect almost any organ. In fact, we're finding COVID-19 as it's not just a respiratory virus. That's pretty clear. And all the scientific reviews after the pandemic in 1918 concluded, as one of them said, second only to pulmonary problems was mental disorders. That's practically a direct quote. One, they, you know, people seem to become schizophrenic. The people Oliver Sacks wrote about in The Awakening, it's hypothesized that they had gotten influenza, and that's why they became almost comatose. There was a disease in the 1920s that surfaced called encephalitis lethargica, kind of self-explanatory, which disappeared. That was considered the last sequel to influenza. And it's very common for people to be totally disoriented, their mind's not functioning. So Wilson gets very seriously ill with influenza in Paris in the middle of the peace conference. And prior to getting ill, he had been adamant and insisting upon the principles that he had brought the United States into the war over, which basically, you know, that was a war to, quote, make the world safe for democracy, unquote. And he wanted peace without victory.
In other words, by peace without victory, peace without triumphalism, and a list of, he had 14 principles that were
exactly
consistent with the idea of, like, we're not looking to punish anybody here.
Exactly. And he gets sick. He becomes disoriented. Everybody who dealt with him commented on this, ranging from Irving Hoover, the White House usher, to Herbert Hoover, who was the who of course went on to be president, and, you know, Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister. Everybody commented how his mind wasn't functioning very well, and he went back to negotiations with the French prime minister, whose Clemenceau, whose nickname was the Tiger. And all of a sudden, he caved in on everything except Clemenceau threw him the bone of the League of Nations. So Germany was punished. You know, the French took control of some German lands. There were reparations. There were all sorts of, you know, things. Wilson himself said if he was a German, he wasn't sure he would sign the peace treaty. And, of course, pretty much every historian says that that peace treaty certainly contributed to the rise of the Nazis and the outbreak of World War II.
I mean, it is stunning that something that had such impact across the globe, right? Killing millions of people. We don't even really know how many specifically died of the Spanish flu. But it's at least tens of millions, right? And that it impacting one individual could have such reverberations for, you know, the rest of at least history as we, you know, we've lived it at this point is, I think, just it's a little mind blowing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, you know, that I look, as we know, individuals matter. Personalities matter. You can look at the White House today. You know, we were in a very different place than we would have been if Hillary Clinton had been elected. So many things would be different. So, you know, people think elections don't matter, whether you're, and they do.
Was there a similar dynamic in 1918 to what we've seen today, where people living in low income or poverty, or people who are Hispanic or African Americans, who are, you know, between those three different cohorts, are suffering the majority of the impact, at least this point, in terms of like the medically, like, is there a similar dynamic from 1918, or are we is our society structured in such a more disparate way now that is more dramatic?
Well, there were plenty of epidemiological studies that looked at how many, you know, the amount of space that someone had in their home, which of course is a function of socioeconomic, which is of course a function of race, often not entirely. And, you know, it's pretty well established that the more square footage you had in your home than in per person, the better off you were. I mean, that makes, you know, logical, you know, you would guess that would be the case. And in fact, it was the case. So, as I said, that, you know, probably correlates to racial disparities. In terms of studies that actually look directly at race, other than, you know, how many people are living in the same house, there's actually a little bit of a mixed bag on that. Some studies did find racial disparities, but there were others that did not.
I want to just touch on too what you had just mentioned earlier, that COVID is not 19 is not just a respiratory infection. I mean, do we have a broader sense of the different? I mean, I know that it can have implications for kidneys. We've seen some variation. What is the what we're seeing with children with the sort of like, I guess, semi Kawasaki disease? I mean, do we have a sense of this? Like, how much? Let me maybe phrase it this way as you answer that question. How much more do we know today than we did, say, in March about this?
Well, we know a lot more today than in March, but we still don't know as much. You know, we're learning what the questions are to ask. We haven't gotten the answers, would be what I think the situation is. You know, all sorts of, and Plus, a lot of these things that we're seeing in Europe and in the United States now, they either didn't occur in China or they weren't reported in China. And, you know, whatever criticism people have of the government of China in terms of their scientific sharing of data from, you know, their own reviews of in published articles in their own scientific journals, and the sharing of the genome, which was quite early, I think January 11th. You know, on the pure science side, they were slow to accept CDC and WHO representatives into the country to look for themselves, but the publications were out there and have been out there. And a lot of these things were not reported in China. And they have good scientists and observers there. So it's not really clear what was going on there, whether it's different, whether the genetic differences, environmental differences, you know, cultural differences, things like that. A lot of questions, not that many answers yet.
So in other words, we could have a specific, as a population, we could have specific medical ailments, or we could have specific environmental factors that are causing the disease to act differently in enough of a people where we pay attention to it, as opposed to maybe in China first.
Conceivably, yeah. I don't want to go overboard on that. You know, the larger differences, if there are any, there may be genetic. But, you know, again, we don't know. And I'm more of an historian than I don't want to oversell myself as a scientist or biologist and so forth. I read these reports, you know, it takes me most of the day just to catch up to my emails. And a lot of that time is spent reading, clinical reports and scientific reports. But I am not a scientist.
All right. Well, fair enough. And so lastly, I mean, in terms of like where, because I know, you know, you did a lot of interviews in the early days of the lockdown. Like where, if we were doing what we're doing now, you know, when you were in March, how concerned would you be, then, and how concerned are you now? In other words, like, has your understanding of like transmission and the way things have handled, has that also evolved, and has that changed your outlook as to where we are today?
Well, it's evolved a little bit. I don't know if it's changed my outlook. You know, it seems that being outside is safer than it looked initially, perhaps. And, you know, CDC concluded that what they call fomites, you know, doorknobs and things like that, are less important than they initially thought in transmission. You know, it seems that face-to-face things like conversation is more important. We always knew something like that was important, but it seems to be even more important. There seems to be more cluster-oriented spread than, so you have super spreading events more than a smoother, flatter, you know, average. So there are differences in terms of how the, not in terms of physically how the virus transmits, but the kind of situations in which the virus is more likely to transmit. In terms of where we are now, I think you try to apply that understanding, which would mean things like church service is probably maybe even more threatening than we might have thought earlier. But, you know, in terms of lockdown and so forth, I do think probably most places came out prematurely. by the same token, there, you know, there are some places where the virus seems to have petered out. We don't fully understand. In Japan, for example, like Japan has done relatively well. And, you know, I think public health measures Japan was not as aggressive as other places in terms of, they closed schools and so forth, but it wasn't the kind of lockdown some other places had, and they were not really great on testing, and they weren't, you know, they were so concerned with the Olympics going forward that they were really kind of slow moving initially, yet they didn't have the explosive spread that we had in the United States. You know, that could be accounted for by cultural differences.
Right.
And probably is certainly a factor. Well, again, I do think, go ahead, ask your question.
Well, okay. So, give me a sense of what you think, will happen. I mean, my understanding is that most experts now feel like this is something that we're going to have, barring a vaccination, which is, you know, I think people had more aspirational perspectives on this than sort of real ones, that we're not going to have a vaccine for some time. And by time, right. I mean, at least, you know, we're measuring this probably in years, less than months, or certainly weeks, that this is going to be sort of an ongoing situation, and we may have to have like some spotty lockdowns in certain areas, but we're going to go forward until we get essentially to some type of like herd immunity over the course of the next, I don't know, year and a half.
I'd probably go along with that. The herd immunity idea, you know, Sweden has been trying that, and so far they haven't been very successful. On a per capita basis, they have more deaths than we do. It's a small country, only 10 million population. And yet they've only got less than 10% of the, not only on a per capita basis, but on, if you adjust for population, just simple math, they have more deaths, considerably more deaths than we have so far. And they have less than 10% of the population has been exposed to the virus. So they're what looked like a pretty interesting effort on herd immunity. It's not going so well right now. And, you know, how long you remain immune to the virus once you get it, what, you know, most people think that'll be at least a year. Hopefully that's correct. The vaccine is the answer. Therapeutic drugs, if we get some really effective ones, as I'm sure you're aware, they could hopefully come online sooner than the vaccine.
Right. And that, the idea is vaccine mitigate the implications of getting it. And we should just say that there's no analog to in the pandemic of 1918. I know that it was that people in the ages, I think it was, if I remember correctly, mid-20s to mid-30s were the sort of primary the death rate was the highest amongst that cohort of people. And that was a function of, at least the speculation is that older people had probably been exposed to a flu that was like similar in some way that ended up giving them more protection. Right. Is that what it was? We don't have anything like that for coronavirus, do we? Or is it just like, this is a straight, okay, this is more just a straight, it really is devastating for people, broadly speaking, obviously many exceptions, but for people who just have compromised immunity.
Correct. You know, nobody, influenza has circulated, other influenza viruses, you know, for a long time, hundreds of years in 1918. And apparently, though, over 90% of the excess mortality back then was people under 65. Now, normally, influenza kills the elderly and kids. As you pointed out, in 1918, that was by no means the case. The elderly essentially escaped. Children died in very large numbers, very large. But the peak age for death was 28. And probably two-thirds of the dead were between 18 and 45. And, of course, right now we're facing a very different profile. But nobody has immunity to this coronavirus. Nobody in the world. It's never circulated before. So you have 100% of the population is potentially susceptible to it. And 1918, and really for any influenza virus, that's probably not quite the same. You probably get some cross protection from having seen other influenza viruses, but nobody has that protection from coronavirus.
Okay. And lastly, and I appreciate you're giving us all this time because I know that your inbox is filling up here, but is there any analog? And I don't want to, obviously, what has taken place over the past couple of days is a function of a problem that we have in our society that obviously, predated the 1918 pandemic. But certainly the lockdown and the impact of this pandemic on the Black community has added to sort of like, I don't know, the tinder, if you will, for what has taken place over the past couple of days. Is there an analog from 1918? Go ahead.
Not really. I agree with what you're saying about currently. Obviously, when you're locked down and lose your job, according to the numbers, 40% of the people making under $40,000 a year lost their jobs. So I remember the 40%. I might be slightly wrong on the dollar figure. So, I mean, you're under tremendous economic stress. Then you find out if you're African American that your race is more subject to death. On top of everything else, you got a lot of reason to be upset. And this, created a tinderbox, as you said. But there was nothing like that in 1918. I mean, you could get into other things that occurred about the same time that led to an outbreaks of violence in 1919. But they were not simply racial. You had soldiers, Black soldiers coming back from the war who'd been treated fairly in Europe and who wanted some rights. And you get race riots in 15 or 20 cities. You get sort of a slaughter in a place called Elaine, Arkansas. Where possibly, quite a few African Americans were killed. Then you have anarchists sending bombs to the Attorney General of the United States. You have police strike in Boston, which got Calvin Coolidge the presidency. You've got a general strike in Seattle, but those all came in 1919. There was the war, sort of. It was a boiling pot and the top, it was a pressure cooker and the top was on during the war and the war ended and you took the top off and everything sort of exploded in 1919. In fact, my original plan was to write a book about 1919, not to write a book about the pandemic. But I ended up diverting my that plan didn't work.
Well,
and obviously ended up writing a book on the pandemic, exclusively on the pandemic.
Well, frankly, I'm glad you did. John Barry, the book is The Great Influenza. We'll put a link to it. I imagine a lot of people hopefully have already are aware of it. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. And thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half, which is not going to be so fun. We're going to go over a lot of the instances of police really initiating a lot of the violence that we saw last night. It's sort of almost in many respects, and over the weekend, I should say, in many respects, the police were, I don't know, there was an old joke. I don't know how old it was, or we would just do it. It was just like, you know, where a scientist has a gun that says, oh, you think I'm mad? You think I'm, or anybody, you know, you think I'm crazy? I'll show you how crazy. And then they shoot themselves. And on some level, the cops last night were basically, or the over the weekend, you're protesting our attitude that we can do anything without any liability, without any accounting. Well, we'll show you how we can do anything without any liability or accounting. Protesting our tendency to be violent, we'll show you that we can be violent. I mean, it's nuts. Just a reminder, this program relies on your support. If you have the resources to become a member, much appreciated. Bounced some ads over the past couple of days, just didn't feel like it was appropriate. We're going to try and start up, over the next couple of days, if not tomorrow. But it's really our members who support this show and make it possible every day. So if you have the resources, join themajorityreport.com. And if you don't, and you're going through any type of financial crunch, and you would like the fun half, the member show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Have patience. We will get to it, but sometimes it takes a couple of weeks, and we will hook you up. And that's majorityreporters@gmail.com. Don't forget the AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com. And tomorrow night, TMBS. Matt, do you know what's happening on TMBS tomorrow night?
I don't know off the top of my head.
I imagine Michael will be doing a deep dive into what we've seen over the past couple of days. But check that out. You can go to patreon.com/TMBS or YouTube, The Michael Brooks Show. Also, Nomiki Konst, check out her show, patreon.com, Nomiki Show, or you can go to YouTube at Nomiki Konst. You can find that on YouTube. She's putting out a lot of stuff, live stuff, I think, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, and show comes out over the weekend. So check that out. And Jamie, imagine you guys have a lot to talk about. Were you, I imagine you were at Barclays Friday night?
I wasn't out on Friday. I was out Thursday, and I was out last night.
And what's happening on the Antifada this week? You guys going to be talking about that?
Yeah. Well, we did kind of a special Twitch stream on Friday about the uprisings currently happening around the country, including right here in New York City. We did some of the political economy of mass incarceration and the police state as we know it. It's kind of tracing back the origins through history and all of the material origins, the ways that race and class combined to create what we have right now. And we had on a few guests, Cole James Cash of Ghetto News Network, and your son, so you probably know him pretty well.
My son.
Yeah. He says that he's your son.
I was hoping he would.
It's going to move in. could call upstate.
There you go.
It's going to be a full house.
There you go. Oh, boy. If he can do something with his siblings to keep them under control, that would be awesome.
Yeah, maybe it could be like a good thing for you guys.
You could, and listen, I'd be willing to try anything at this point. I'm open to it. I'm totally open to it. I hope he's also good with needles, because I'm looking for someone to take over my recent job as a cat diabetic insulin provider. So
they are both part of the family, so I'm sure that they'll work it out.
Great.
Yeah. Anyway.
Matt, do you have a report on any of my long-lost children?
No. Go finish up, Jamie. You had more to say, Jamie?
Yeah, I mean, this is like way more fun, but yeah, I should probably finish telling you about my show. We also had on Leslie Lee III from Struggle Session and Rob Rousseau from Canada, because I know everyone was waiting for the Canadian perspective on what's going on here. And that is free for anyone who wants to watch it on Twitch. And we also edited it into a podcast version and took out all of the parts where me and Sean were just trying to figure out how to use the computer. So that's a premium offering for our patrons.
That's pretty good. Matt?
Twitch.tv/literary hangover. Saturday night, I played some of my protest footage. I walked down Flatbush. I caught some of the car, the SUV that rammed the protesters on Flatbush. I caught that after it had done that and was surrounded by other vehicles. So you can check out that footage. And it's in the most recent stream I did at twitch.tv/literary hangover. Probably going to stream again tonight. Probably not to maybe take our minds off of it if you want someplace to not think about this. But otherwise, get in the streets, I think. It's I always feel a little bit ambivalent about doing a Twitch stream when there's like history happening in the streets. But if you want to avoid it for a little bit, twitch.tv/literary hangover.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half. We should also just mark, I mean, it's obviously a little bit of a coincidence, and but we're 99 years out from the Tulsa massacres. She's not a huge amount of progress, but I guess some. Well, I don't know. I don't know how to measure that, but I think some progress, but not.
Yeah. Hopefully no major massacres.
Insufficient. Yeah, indeed. There's a couple of cops out there I've seen footage of that I'm like, there's really very little that I would not put past some of these guys. All right, quick break. Head into the fun half, number 646-257-3920. We'll be right back after this. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance. My first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook. Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.